The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time magazine is dated May 24/May 31, 2021. The title is Visions of Equity, in large print black on a white banner, beneath which the very large capital letters of Time in white are superimposed upon a portrait. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red, and the portrait is entitled God Bless the Child by Jordan Castile. That's C-A-S-T-E-E-L. It does picture two persons of color. One is the apparent mother dressed in a blue, well, aquamarine gown or shirt. We see only the top of her, with a lot of black curly hair. We see very few facial features. The nose and the mouth are identified, and in the arm, in the right arm, is cradled a child with dark hair and braids and a tan skin color and wrapped somehow in pink with red flowers. The description for on the cover, Jordan Castile, God Bless the Child, 2019. Oil on canvas, 36 by 30 inches. That is not the depiction here. It's more like 8 by 11. Jordan Castile, it's the copyright holder, courtesy Casey Kaplan, New York. Photo credit, because this is a photograph of the portrait, Jason Weish, from the private collection of Dr. Anita Blanchard and Martin Nesbitt. Turning now to the text found within this issue of Time magazine. For the record, some brief articles. How am I supposed to represent a country that does not even represent me? Stated by Liz Cambage, Australian WNBA player, in a May 6 Instagram story criticizing a promotional photo shoot in Australia's Olympic and Paralympic teams that featured no athletes of color. After threatening to boycott the Tokyo Games, Cambage said she will participate. 95, the age of Cecil Lockhart when he died May 4. Lockhart's liver was later donated to a woman in her 60s, making him the oldest organ donor in U.S. history. It is clear that China is failing to meet responsible standards regarding their space debris, Bill Nelson, NASA administrator, said in a May 8 statement on debris from the Chinese Long March 5B rocket, which splashed into the Indian Ocean May 9 after an uncontrolled re-entry from orbit. 25 million yen, amount of COVID-19 stimulus funding, about $225,000, spent by a Japanese fishing port on a large statue of a squid intended to attract tourists. As fun as it is just not a challenge anymore, stated by Ellen DeGeneres in a May 12 interview with The Hollywood Reporter, explaining why she decided the forthcoming 19th season of her daytime talk show, which faced allegations in July of a toxic workplace, will be its last. 9 is the number of babies a 25-year-old Malian woman gave birth to May 4, believed to be a world record. I'm not sure what the number above octuplets is. I stand behind what I'm doing, though it is painful for me that I cannot do it in tune with church leadership. From the Reverend Jan Kordichka, a German Jesuit discussing his decision to bless queer couples despite a recent Holy See decree banning the practice. Around 100 churches across Germany offered such services the week of May 10. Good news of the week, a World Wildlife Fund study released May 11 found that across the world, areas of forest equivalent to the size of France have regrown over the past 20 years. And finally, we must speak the truth. Our election was not stolen, and America has not failed. By Liz Cheney, Wyoming Republican, in a May 11 speech, the day before she was ousted from the GOP House leadership after she continued to rebut former President Trump's false claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. India's disaster is a global crisis. This is a one-page article beneath the heading, The Brief Opener and World, written by Billy Perigo. High in the thin air of the Mount Everest base camp in Nepal, Sherpas and climbers used to walk freely from one group of tents to another, holding gatherings, singing and dancing. Now the Sherpas who escort climbers to the summit have a new job, enforcing unofficial social distancing rules. Climbing Everest is always a matter of life and death, says Funuru Sherpa. But this year the risk has been doubled due to COVID. Already, dozens of people with suspected COVID-19 have been evacuated by helicopter. The outbreak reflects a broader one again across Nepal, which shares a long, porous border with India. Daily confirmed cases in the Himalayan nation increased 30-fold from April 11 to May 11, when 9,300 infections were recorded. It is a grim omen of how India's devastating COVID-19 crisis may be turning into an even bigger global emergency. As countries around the world airlift oxygen, vaccines, and medical supplies to India, they're also closing their borders to the world's second most populous country. It may already be too late. The B.1.617 variant of the virus, first detected in India, has now been found in 44 countries on every continent except Antarctica, including Nepal, the U.S., and much of Europe. Scientists say it could be more infectious and better at avoiding humans' immune systems. May 10, the World Health Organization declared it a variant of global concern. And because only around 0.1% of positive samples in India are being genetically sequenced, there may well be others that have emerged, says Amita Gupta, Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Clinical Global Health Education. The true scale of the COVID-19 outbreak in India is impossible to accurately quantify. Officially, confirmed daily cases are plateauing just under 400,000, but remain higher than any other country has seen during the pandemic. Experts warn the real numbers are far bigger and may still be rising fast as the virus rips through rural India, where 2/3 of the population lives and where testing infrastructure is frail. the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, estimates the true number of new daily infections is around 8 million, the equivalent of the entire population of New York City being infected every day. Official reports say 254,000 people have died in India since the start of the pandemic, but the IHME estimates the true toll is more than 750,000, a number researchers predict will double by the end of August. Since the beginning of May, dozens of bodies have washed up on the banks of the River Ganges, with some villagers saying they were forced to leave the dead in the water amid soaring funeral costs and shortages of wood for cremation. Experts say the crisis was entirely predictable and that rich countries could have done more to prevent it. The pandemic has once again highlighted the extreme international inequity in access to life-saving vaccines and drugs, says Bina Agarwal, a professor of development economics and environment at the University of Manchester. The Indian government failed to order enough vaccines for its population or ramp up its vaccination program fast enough. But for months, the U.S. also blocked exports of crucial raw materials India needed to manufacture vaccines and stockpiled 20 million AstraZeneca shots, even though the FDA had not authorized their use. Although President Biden has now changed course, sending much-needed vaccine raw materials to India and pledging to export the AstraZeneca shots, it will take a long time for the country to catch up. Only 2.8% of the population was fully vaccinated as of May 12. India's brutal second COVID-19 wave is sparking worries that the worst of this global pandemic is still ahead. Especially concerning are densely populated African countries, many of which have yet to experience large outbreaks. Versions of the B.1.617 variant have already been reported in Angola, Rwanda, and Morocco. Many of the vaccines that could curb outbreaks in such countries were meant to come from factories in India, which has now ordered that most of its vaccine production be used domestically. Meanwhile, tragedy is sparing few families across India. Rahul Thakkar, a 42-year-old vice president of a healthcare startup, died of COVID-19 May 10. After the New Delhi ICU ward where he was being treated ran out of oxygen in late April. When the infrastructure breaks down, being rich or poor does not save you, says Ramanan Lakshminaranyan, a friend of Thakkar's. Lakshminaranyan, an Indian-American epidemiologist and director of the D.C.-based think tank Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy, began an international fundraising campaign, raising more than $9 million to import oxygen cylinders and concentrators, which turn air into medical-grade oxygen. The effort should never have been necessary, Lakshminaranyan says. While India should have invested in its pandemic preparedness, he says, developed countries share a portion of responsibility. Even out of a sense of self-protection, rich countries should have planned much better for vaccinating the entire world and increasing production, Lakshminaranyan says. What happens in India does not stay in India. This has reporting by Rohita Adhikari, Mount Everest Base Camp, Nepal. Within the Nation column, which was written by Emily Barone, the first item is the U.S. birth rate dropped in 2020, but don't blame it all on COVID-19. About 142,000 fewer babies were born in the U.S. in 2020 than in 2019, according to provisional figures from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, released May 5. In total, there were 3.6 million births in 2020, a 4% drop from 2019. Additionally, the general fertility rate also dropped 4% last year to 55.8 births per 1,000 women ages 15 to 44, who account for 99.7% of births. That rate set a record low for the country, according to the CDC. But unlike most health news pertaining to last year, the COVID-19 pandemic was not the primary cause for the decline. While COVID-19 may have played some role in the number of births during the final weeks of the year, the overall picture is more indicative of a continued fertility decline in the country. The vast majority of 2020 babies were conceived before the pandemic's onset. Full-term babies conceived around January 22, when the first case of COVID-19 was reported in the U.S., were born in late October. And those conceived after March 13, when the U.S. declared a national emergency, were born starting in mid-December. Since 2014, the last year during which the number of births increased, the U.S. has experienced a six-year downward streak, averaging 2% fewer births per year. Birth rates have been sinking across demographics, and 2020 was no exception. Every race and ethnic group and every age group from 15 to 44 had a lower rate. For girls ages 15 to 19, the rate dropped 8%, continuing a decline in teen pregnancy apparent every year since 1991. With the exception of 2006 and 2007. Many issues exacerbated by the pandemic, including financial instability, health-related anxieties, and a lack of support for working parents, could factor into the drop in births continuing in 2021. The matters motivating some lawmakers to act. The American Rescue Plan upped this year's child tax credits to $3,600 for each child under 6 and to $3,000 for children up to 17. More recently, President Biden has floated proposals to expand paid leave programs and improve child care access and affordability. Whether those ideas become legislation is uncertain, however, as Republicans are not fully supportive. In the news ticker, three very short items. NCAA exec supports athlete deals. National Collegiate Athletic Association President Mark Emmert told the New York Times May 8 he would now recommend colleges enact rules allowing student athletes to accept endorsement deals in the face of new laws in Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and New Mexico. Laos records first COVID-19 death. More than a year into the pandemic, Laos recorded its first COVID-19-related death May 9, state media reported. The 53-year-old woman's death comes amid a surge in cases in the country after the Lao New Year holiday, which took place in mid-April, and a wider wave of infections across Southeast Asia. Biden restores LGBTQ health protections. The Biden administration announced May 10 it will protect gay and transgender people against sex discrimination in health care, reversing a Trump-era policy that had defined one sex as the gender assigned at birth, excluding transgender people. Under the milestones heading, a page here, there's a photograph in color that's a bunch of machinery above ground, painted in shades of blue and gray and white and yellow. And there's a chain link fence with barbed wire atop it surrounding this. And there are signs in front of the chain link fence that say warning and then something, 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 which is unreadable to me. And the heading reads, by the way, the sky is blue and filled with fluffy white clouds, and the ground is a sandy-colored tan around all this equipment. And the caption reads, a colonial pipeline station facility in Pasadena, Texas. Attacked. Colonial pipeline. U.S. oil flow held hostage. The latest in a string of high-profile incidents that have exposed critical vulnerabilities in America's infrastructure systems, a May 7 cyber attack on a major U.S. pipeline choked off the oil supply to much of the East Coast. The Colonial Pipeline, which sends more than 100 million gallons of fuel daily from Houston to New York, was forced to shut down operations after hackers penetrated its computer networks, leaving over a dozen states scrambling for gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. The FBI has since traced the attack to Dark Side. That's one word, Dark Side. A cybercrime gang based in Eastern Europe that is notorious for hacking into companies' systems, encrypting their files, and extorting them to pay large ransoms to unlock the data. In 2020 alone, $350 million was paid out by the U.S. government for ransomware attacks, according to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. The White House formed a task force to ensure greater flexibility in fuel transport until the problem was fixed. The agencies across the government have acted quickly to mitigate any impact on our fuel supply, President Joe Biden said. Despite DarkSide's suspected links to Moscow, Biden did not directly blame the Kremlin, but said there was evidence that the actors' ransomware is in Russia and that they have some responsibility to deal with this. That item was written by W.J. Hennigan. Died Bo, B-O, the Obama family's pet dog, at age 12, May 8, after a battle with cancer, the family said in a statement. At least nine people, after a gunman opened fire at a school in the Russian town of Kazan, May 11. Officials have said a 19-year-old suspect is in custody. Canceled the broadcast of the Golden Globes ceremony on NBC, the network said May 10, amid controversy over the award's lack of diversity. Concluded a three-year-long inquest into the 1971 killing of 10 people during a British Army operation in Belfast. The report, released May 11, found the victims were entirely innocent. Failed. A drug test by 2021 Kentucky Derby winner Medina Spirit shortly after winning, the Colts trainer confirmed May 9. Sentenced two American men to life in prison in Italy May 5 after being found guilty of the 2019 murder of an Italian police officer. Inducted Jay-Z, Tina Turner, and the Foo Fighters, among others, into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the organization announced May 12. Elected the Reverend Megan Rohrer, R-O-H-R-E-R, the first openly trans person to be elected bishop in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, May 8. And finally, a slightly larger article, died Olympia Dukakis, an actor's actor and a coach, by Garcia, as told to Sonia Mansour. There's a black and white photo here of Dukakis seated at a desk with her feet up on the desk. It's in a fashionable place. She's has her head turned toward the camera, but away from a window overlooking tall buildings. There's floral drapery at the side of the window and a striped wallpaper pattern with wainscoting and a crystal lamp on the desk. Dukakis is gray-haired, and she's wearing a dark outfit, a skirt and jacket. It's not possible for me to tell you the colors because it's in black and white. Olympia Dukakis was tough, but it came from a place of believing in others' talent, and she was loved for her honesty. I would know, having worked with her filming the 2019 Netflix Tales of the City series and sitting in on her acting classes in college. In addition to her decades-long film career, including the Look Who's Talking movies, Steel Magnolias, and an Oscar-winning performance in the 1987 rom-com Moonstruck, Dukakis, who died May 1, at the age of 89, taught drama at New York University for more than 15 years. She never held back with sharing her wisdom, whether an acting tip or a note that my decision to once bleach my hair a terrible white blonde was not a great one, and I'm a better actor for it. She played the role of Anna Madrigal, a trans woman in four Tales of the City series, based on Armistead Maupin's classic novels. Madrigal was a character who had made multiple hard decisions in her life, but moved through turmoil with grace, hope, and presence. To me, that was what Olympia embodied as a person. There are actresses who just walk into a room and they take up some space, and she was one of them. Beneath the brief health headline, teens get their shot. It should be teens get their shots. I hope they're not all sharing one shot. This is by Alice Park, and it shows a colored photograph of apparently a clinical setting. It has a frosted glass window in the background with some stacks of Kleenex on the windowsill, and a pale cream-colored wall and some wood paneling and what looks like probably a laminate desktop. There is a woman with dark hair knotted back into a ponytail, and she's wearing the protective healthcare worker's goggles and a face mask with a blue, bright blue smock. And she is apparently, we cannot see the top of the child's arm, but she's apparently injecting vaccine into the arm of a youngster, a boy with also very dark hair and glasses and wearing a face mask. And he's wearing a gray T-shirt that says something about I paused something. And then down at the bottom, Chandra. Well, anyway, here's the article by Alice Park. Now that seniors and adults are getting vaccinated, it's the teens' turn. Adolescents ages 12 to 15 are next people eligible to get Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 shots, says the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which recently extended authorization to this group. The vaccine becomes the first COVID-19 shot deemed safe and effective for this younger population. The agency's decisions came after health officials reviewed data the two companies released in March, showing that two doses of their vaccine provided similar protection from COVID-19 disease among adolescents as it did for adults. Among the more than 2,200 teens in the study group the FDA reviewed, only 16 developed COVID-19, and none were in the vaccinated group. In fact, the research suggests the vaccine may work even better in this age group than it does in those who are a few years older. The company's studies found that levels of virus-fighting antibodies were on average higher among the 12 to 15-year-olds who got the vaccine than among vaccinated 16 to 25-year-olds in previous studies. The FDA authorization comes just in time for summer, as parents weigh whether it's safe to send children to camp. It also lays the groundwork for a way to more safely open schools in the fall, assuming parents take their teens to get their shots. While younger children tend to experience milder forms of COVID-19, the disease can still trigger serious illness in some, especially those with underlying conditions like asthma and diabetes. Immunizing teens can help not only to protect them, but also to extend the wall of human immunity that's essential for slowing the spread of the virus. In some ways, this first authorization for a COVID-19 vaccine for children was the easy part. The hurdle now is to get those shots into arms. In a recent Kaiser Family Foundation survey, only about a third of parents of 12 to 15-year-olds said they would get their kids vaccinated. A quarter said they'd wait and see how other children responded to the shot before deciding. Dr. Allison Messina, chief of infectious disease at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, hopes that when undecided parents see vaccinated children doing more of the activities they've missed over the past year, from sports to social gatherings, they will be more comfortable vaccinating their own kids. Some may not have much choice when it comes to getting their children back in the classroom. Some universities are already requiring students to be immunized before returning to campus in the fall, and primary and secondary schools may follow suit to avoid outbreaks. To make vaccination as easy as possible for families, the Biden administration plans to ship doses directly to pediatricians' offices, where many kids get their health care. To facilitate this plan, Pfizer BioNTech is adding smaller shipment options of its shot to accommodate the needs of individual doctors' offices, which may require fewer doses than mass vaccination sites. Public health experts say vaccinating teens will not only keep those who get the shot healthy, but will also protect the only remaining group that is not yet eligible for vaccination, the youngest children in families. Studies on the safety and efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccines in children ages 6 months to 11 years are still ongoing. If you can protect as many people as possible in the household, then you're also indirectly protecting those who cannot yet be vaccinated by providing fewer opportunities for the virus to come in, says Dr. Flor Munoz, a specialist in pediatric infectious disease at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. That applies on a much broader scale to the country as a whole. The more people vaccinated and able to ward off the virus, the fewer new infections the virus can seed, and the sooner the pandemic will wane. The brief environment is the heading for this article. The pandemic creates a trash epidemic, by Alana Samuels. There's a photo here in color, captioned "Trash on a New York City sidewalk, January 7th. There is a smallish wireframe trash bin overflowing, like quadruple or quintuple the amount of trash that this thing would hold, is inside the bin and all around it on a brick sidewalk. Boxes, bottles, cups, paper bags, plastic bags, napkins. I can't read. One says Coney Island something or other. One says Magic Hat 9. Those are the only things I think I can read. Some of them look like donut bags and maybe Mountain Dew carton. Anyway, it's a mess. Across the country, as the weather improved and pandemic lockdowns were lifted, Americans ventured outside and noticed their neighborhoods looked a little different, a little dirtier. They saw mattresses piled outside cemeteries and disposable masks clogging gutters. Vacuum cleaners left in the woods, fast food wrappers blowing on the highway, piles of tires. Neighborhoods that had been relatively clean before the pandemic were now full of litter. There is garbage freaking everywhere, says David Biederman, the executive director and CEO of Solid Waste Association of North America, SWANA. In Portland, Oregon, the city picked up more garbage in 2020 than in any other year on record, 3,000 tons, 50% more than in 2019. Additionally, requests to clean up trash and remove graffiti were up 300%. Norfolk, Virginia is seeing historic highs in litter and illegal dumping, according to Sarah Sturtzing, education manager of Keep Norfolk Beautiful. Reports of illegal dumping to Keep Pennsylvania Beautiful were up 213% in 2020 over 2019. I am going to share this with you. I read that last sentence in the manner I believe it was meant to be written and read, but it's actually written, reports of illegal dumping to Keep Pennsylvania Beautiful were up 213% in 2020 over 2019. Moving on, there were 24 billion pieces of litter alongside highways and 26 billion pieces of litter along waterways in 2020, according to data compiled by the nonprofit litter prevention group Keep America Beautiful and shared exclusively with Time. While this is actually less litter than a similar survey counted in 2009, it does not include litter in places like public parks and neighborhoods, where pedestrians were most likely to exercise and socialize, think hikes, picnics, and street parties, when the pandemic made it virtually impossible to take part in such activities indoors. Keep America Beautiful has received a number of complaints about litter shifting from downtowns to neighborhoods, says David Scott, Senior Director of Research. As people shift to socializing outside, other countries, including the UK, Canada, and Jordan, are seeing a litter problem too. A few factors are driving the rise in trash. Budget cuts have forced some cities to reduce sanitation department staff, which means fewer trash pickups. In New Orleans, sales tax declines led to cuts of 20% or more in some departments. COVID-19 outbreaks have hit sanitation workers. Baltimore stopped collecting bulk trash and suspended street sweeping and cleaning of vacant lots because so many of its workers fell ill. Meanwhile, people are creating more residential garbage than in the past. They are buying single-use personal protective equipment, PPE, like gloves and masks. Keep America Beautiful estimates there were about 207 million pieces of PPE litter on the ground at any given time in late 2020. They're getting takeout from restaurants and throwing out their wrappers and plastic forks. The amount of residential waste that haulers are collecting is up 5% to 8% from the same time the previous year, according to SWANA. Although some of the increases in residential trash are offset by decreases in trash in commercial settings like office buildings, that is not the case everywhere. In Ohio's Montgomery County, public waste was up 5.7%, while commercial waste was down 0.6%. But the county still collected more waste in total than it did in 2019 or 2018. But there's something else driving this trend toward trash. People seem to have given up on many things during isolation. That includes cleaning up after themselves. It's like life sucks. I'll just throw this out the window, says Julian Lehman, the director of Keep Gastonia Beautiful in North Carolina, where the city council recently doubled fines for littering because there's been such an increase. In February, the state doubled fines for littering on highways. We've all got these COVID bellies. You just kind of give up a little bit. Once people leave a piece or two of trash on the ground, the behavior can quickly become contagious. It is simple human nature. You want to follow the rules, but if you see other people breaking them and not getting punished, you stop too, says Robert H. Frank, a Cornell University economist and author of the book Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. If you see a lot of trash strewn about, that makes you more likely to litter too. The behavior is not limited to litter. Illegal dumping has increased in a number of cities as people try to figure out how to dispose of things like tires or broken refrigerators without paying a fee. In Portland, that's meant a bump in bulky waste around the city. People also stopped being careful about how to dispose of their recycling during the pandemic. Recycling depends on haulers collecting and separating things like cardboard, glass, and plastic so they can repackage and sell those items. But many recycling programs saw more contamination in their waste streams as people tried to recycle jars full of food or put clothes in recycling instead of trash. About one-third of recycling in Monterey, California was contaminated in 2020, up from 22% the year before. Contamination increased by 41% in Indianapolis during the pandemic. About 100 cities and towns, including Montclair, New Jersey, and El Paso, Texas, suspended curbside recycling during the pandemic. Some, including Gastonia, North Carolina, suspended it because contamination was so high. Philadelphia collected 20% more trash in 2020 than in 2019, but 34% less recycling, according to the city's streets department. We may be in a new place where there's not necessarily the intestinal fortitude to take the extra effort to dispose of things in the right way, says Brian Love, a professor at the University of Michigan, who has looked at why recycling programs disappeared during the pandemic. For some environmentalists, the problem shows individuals should not be expected to figure out how to dispose of goods once they're done with them. They say manufacturers should be responsible for collecting products that are difficult to recycle or throw away, like paint or mattresses or plastic bags. Without financial incentives and penalties that control waste generation and packaging production, excess waste and litter is the obvious result, says Scott Castle, founder of the Product Stewardship Institute, a nonprofit that focuses on reducing the environmental impacts of consumer products. We need to require producers to take greater responsibility for the packaging they put on the marketplace. Democrats introduced a bill on the House and Senate floors in March that aims to do just that. The Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act would require consumer brands to pay to collect and recycle waste left by their products. It would also impose a fee on carry-out bags and require certain non-recyclable, single-use plastic products to be eliminated from the waste stream. A similar bill introduced last year did not make headway in Congress. Keep America Beautiful is encouraging people to participate in the group's Great American Cleanup, which connects volunteers to local trash cleanup opportunities from March to June. Local governments are still scrambling. South Carolina, which saw a dramatic increase in litter, is spending $2 million a year for private contractors to clean its roads, the first time it has done so. The state, like many others, had relied on prison labor to clean up litter, but suspended that program because of the pandemic. As the litter problem in Portland worsened during the pandemic, city leaders figured the government could not stop the dumping alone. The city raised $100,000 from the private sector to launch a new cleanup initiative and is seeking $1 million more. Beneath the Brief Nation heading, Can Amtrak Get Rolling Again? By Patrick Lucas Austin. Here's a photo of Amtrak passengers disembark in Emeryville, California. It's a sleek-looking train parked there on the rails. It looks like a mom and two little children are getting off. She's carrying a stroller in one hand, and she's got a baby strapped to her chest, and she's got a backpack, and she's got a little girl by the hand in the other hand. And leaning against that slick-looking locomotive engine is possibly the engineer. It's a big, burly man wearing blue overalls and a gray T-shirt. Or maybe he's not the engineer. As the Biden administration seeks to fight climate change, encouraging train travel over emission-heavy alternatives like flying or driving could be one solution. But Amtrak, the country's major passenger rail service, has a reputation for slow service, delays, and poor access. To help turn things around, President Joe Biden's proposing an $80 billion investment in Amtrak as part of his American Jobs Plan. Could that be enough to get the country a true high-speed rail network? Likely not. But Amtrak CEO William Flynn, who took charge of the semi-public for-profit operator last spring, has big plans regardless. Before the pandemic, Amtrak, which turned 50 years old May 1, looked to be on the right track. It posted revenue of about $3.5 billion in fiscal 2019, up nearly 3.5% year over year. But revenue crashed by nearly a third in 2020 amid the COVID-19 outbreak. After weathering the pandemic, Flynn's next job is to get Amtrak rolling again. In an interview with Time, Flynn says his priority is repairing existing infrastructure, primarily along the Northeast Corridor, NEC, which runs between Washington, D.C. and Boston, and which carried 12.5 million passengers in 2019, while also increasing service. The president talked about expanding intercity passenger rail across our country, and that is something that we have a very clear plan and strategy for, says Flynn. What about high-speed rail? Amtrak's trains run at high speeds along only two stretches of the NEC, totaling 173 miles. Myriad non-Amtrak ultra-fast projects are in the works in places like the Pacific Northwest, Texas, and California, but none are near completion and they could be scrapped. For now, Amtrak's planning only minor speed upgrades. Improvements along the NEC will allow Amtrak's latest Acela trains, that's A-C-E-L-A, to travel up to 160 miles per hour, but only along about 35 miles of track between Boston and New Haven, Connecticut. Amtrak says Acela trains generally operate at 100 miles per hour to 135 miles per hour across most of the NEC. By contrast, true high-speed rail systems in Europe and Asia reach up to 200 miles per hour for long stretches of rail. Still, Amtrak riders may be able to expect other improvements in the near future, like more frequent trains and service in new cities, including Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Columbus, Ohio. A large part of that growth, says Flynn, will occur on freight rail infrastructure. It is easier to put more trains on existing lines than it is to build high-speed rail lines, which requires massive investments and land rights. But Amtrak trains running on freight lines are often delayed, as freight trains get priority. Moreover, the plan may have costs of its own, including the need for a more sophisticated control system, says Christopher Barkin, a professor at the University of Illinois and executive director of the Rail Transportation and Engineering Center. At least one U.S. representative is pushing the Biden administration to think bigger. If we just put more passenger trains on already congested freight lines, people are not going to leave their cars to ride the train, says Congressman Seth Moulton, a Democrat from Massachusetts. In December, he introduced the American High-Speed Rail Act, a bill calling for an ambitious national high-speed rail system. It includes $205 billion in federal investment and encourages public-private partnerships, a strategy that's worked in Japan and elsewhere. Americans will ride the train if the service is better. That's the bottom line, says Moulton. For now, Flynn's hoping that a more realistic strategy will help Amtrak find its way out of the pandemic and back into Americans' hearts, especially as vaccination continues and people feel increasingly comfortable traveling. There's so much latent capability in the existing structures that need, in some placements, reinvestment, where we can build out train schedules and services that you and I would want to take, says Flynn. That investment has to be key to the strategy, the national strategy. Here are a couple more short items from the news ticker. Biden greenlights major wind project. May 11, the Biden administration approved what will be the U.S.'s first large-scale offshore wind farm, which could generate power for up to 400,000 homes and businesses. The $2.8 billion project will install turbines off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, with construction set to start later this year. Afghanistan girls' school bombed, three explosions targeting a girls' school in Kabul May 8. Killed at least 85 people and wounded 147 more, many of them teenage girls. The Taliban has denied responsibility for the blasts, which come as the U.S. begins its military withdrawal from the country after 20 years. Georgia shootings classified as hate crime. Prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, said the man accused of killing 8 people in a series of shootings at Atlanta area spas in March, targeted some victims because they were of Asian descent and classified the event as a hate crime. County District Attorney Fannie Willis said she will pursue the death penalty. From within the Equity Agenda, which is the heading for a series of short articles, comes this one, written by Jasmine Aguilera, and family detention. The U.S. has 3 detention centers specifically for immigrant families, where children are held as they wait for courts to decide whether they and their parents will be allowed to stay in the U.S. The American Academy of Pediatrics says children should never be placed in detention because of the physical and psychological toll it takes, even for a short time. And yet the last several administrations have detained immigrant parents and their children for months at a time. As long as the U.S. detains families, it can never live up to its ideal of being a land of opportunity, says Bridget Cambria, executive director of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, which represents detained families. Family detention is a travesty of human rights, Cambria says. The government doesn't have to detain anyone. It's a choice. Reform the thrifty food plan. Adequate access to food is economic justice. Too many people are forced to stretch their Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, benefits because they do not cover the full cost of food. The program is determined by the federal government's Thrifty Food Plan, TFP, a 46-year-old plan, last updated in 2006, that does not reflect the current economy. All these factors disproportionately impact people of color. It is time to reevaluate the TFP to increase SNAP benefits as a critical step forward toward equity. By Parker L. Gilkison, Policy Analyst. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.